You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest is Nathaniel Popkin, author of the new novel on tension over Israel in synagogues today, Partly Strong, Partly Broken. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. You may have read last week that the newish American Pope, Leo, issued a long encyclical called Magnifica Humanitas, which translates as Magnificent Humanity. Now, a papal encyclical is a big deal, particularly for Catholics, but for all religious types, really, and even for those who aren't religious, since they can change public discussion on an issue worldwide. Papal encyclicals are issued whenever the current pope chooses to do so, so there's no set pattern. Sometimes they represent a significant change in the direction of the whole Catholic Church, a huge organization with a hierarchical structure, which still has significant influence in the world, even if it's not what it once was. While papal encyclicals can be just rebottled piety, or may reaffirm conservative positions on contemporary issues, they can also jump the line and change things dramatically. Perhaps most famously, Pope John XXIII organized the Vatican II Council, and his successor, Pope Paul VI, formally issued the encyclical Nostra Aetate, which transformed the Catholic Church's relationship with non-Christians, you know, like Jews, and formally rejected both the charge of deicide, that is, killing God in the form of Jesus, and all anti-Semitism after nearly two millennia of its tacit acceptance by the Church. That created a huge sea change in official Roman Catholic Church policy, and while it took time to fully impact the large Catholic world, it transformed the way many Catholics saw Jews and Judaism and built positive relationships that have endured. So this is the very first encyclical ever issued by Pope Leo XIV. He is famously the first pope ever from the United States and a Chicago White Sox fan. The subject is not just how remarkable and extraordinary human beings are, but how and why artificial intelligence is a challenge to our very humanity. This encyclical is over 40,000 words long, basically about half as long as the average book, so my comments are limited to the fact that I only mostly scanned it and read reviews of it. And of course, I used artificial intelligence to analyze it for me. Just kidding. In some ways, my first impression is that coming from the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church, it reads shockingly like a Renaissance humanist text. The focus of this document is to elevate the extraordinary beauty, talent, goodness, and even fallibility of our shared humanity. While it certainly views human beings as creations of God and reflections of the divine image and spirit, it's filled with statements about the rich and vibrant qualities we human beings possess. How amazing and beautiful we are. How our talents and choices and intelligence are unique, special, sacred. How we are the earthly reflections of God's grandeur. In this way, the Pope's words remind me of that lovely Shakespearean soliloquy from Hamlet. What a piece of work is man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. Now, coming from the leader of a religion profoundly focused on the afterlife and redemption from sin, as the Roman Catholic Church is, this is spicy stuff. A quotidian focus on the mortal dressed up in the fanciest robes of the church. It's much closer to the heady humanism of Erasmus than it is to the more typically pious preaching we expect from the Catholic Church's vicar on earth. However, the real focus of this long encyclical is on the problem posed by the rapidly increasing use of artificial intelligence in so many aspects of life. The Pope notes that this is done in the name of greater efficiency, at the cost of true human creativity, of jobs, or the unpredictable and often inspiring randomness of actual people doing their own work. We are at the forefront, the beginning, the appetizer stage of the use of artificial intelligence, and Pope Leo is worried we will all simply fall into the traps that this still-developing technology offers us. He cites the Bible, our Tanakh. The Pope compares artificial intelligence to the Tower of Babel, a towering city built on pride and dictatorial direction. That story ends badly, of course. In contrast, the Pope writes about the way Nehemiah worked to rebuild Jerusalem after the Jewish returned from the Babylonian exile, gathering the people together, creating a communal shared response, respecting the whole people, sharing responsibility with everyone. Obviously, for Pope Leo, that is the best, most appropriate way for human beings to use their own intelligence in order to make a better, holier world. As he says, technology has the power to heal, connect, educate, and protect our common home, but can also divide, exclude, and generate new forms of injustice. In the abstract, technology in and of itself is not a solution to humanity's problems, just as it is not inherently evil. In practice, however, technology is never neutral because it takes on the characteristics of those who devise, finance, regulate, and use it. Therefore, the primary choice is not between a yes or no to technology, but rather between constructing Babel or rebuilding Jerusalem, between a power that claims to dominate the heavens and a people who work together in the presence of God to rebuild the walls of fraternal coexistence. You know, for some of us, our dark images of artificial intelligence and its potential danger were shaped by Stanley Kubrick's movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, in which the evil computer HAL kills most of the astronauts in order to protect itself. That was not a positive presentation of artificial intelligence. Understand that artificial intelligence has taken a long time to get up to speed. People started working hard on it way back in the early 1950s, and in spite of lots of resources poured into AI, nothing seemed to really work. For decades, the closest we got was a chess-playing computer. But behind the scenes, faster computers, more memory, and slow progress eventually produced a series of breakthroughs, which mostly involved the ways that machines learn. Finally, in 2020, less than 6 years ago, OpenAI released the first version of what rapidly triggered this artificial intelligence revolution. And it is that revolution the Pope took aim at. And he has a point. You may remember a couple of years ago, back in the fall of 2023, a Reform rabbi, Rabbi Josh Fixler, trained artificial intelligence to write in his own style and to produce a voice that sounded like his own delivering the sermon. And it temporarily fooled his congregation. That caused a stir. The ultimate message of that sermon was that artificial intelligence cannot replace the empathy and human skills of an actual rabbi. But it sure can do the pesky research that used to take us so many hours, right? A couple of thoughts about artificial intelligence. First, I personally believe that like any new technology, it is a new tool with great potential. All new technologies create disruption and require adaptation periods, and AI is no different. All new technologies benefit some people financially and hurt others. There's no way around this. Raging against new tech is, well, silly. I recall one of the first congregations I served as a cantor when I was still a teenager. A sermon one of the lay people gave one Shabbat said, "They're starting to build cars with robots. After all the auto workers lose their jobs, which robots are going to buy the cars the other robots are building?" And yet, you know, we still have and buy cars, and the displaced auto workers are now doing other jobs. As to human creativity, well, I might have even more faith in the human being than the Pope does. There are painful tasks we currently must perform that AI can do better and faster. And that's all to the good. And there will always be things we can do that AI doesn't do. Things that are uniquely human. Machines, for all the ways they are being made to simulate human beings, do not feel. They do not care. They do not have actual empathy. They do not build true community. They do not pray. Machines do not love. But we do. It is our profoundly human gift, given by God, that in our emotional, inspirational messiness, we have the great capacity to care and love and, yes, hate, and bring meaning to our limited lives. And those gifts are something we cannot bestow on a machine, no matter how sophisticated it becomes. So, my friends, use artificial intelligence wherever it's useful. But don't get too captivated by your devices and your tools. Because what really matters is that remarkable spark of the divine you carry inside you, that profound, ineffable, innate humanity. To play us in this morning on Too Jewish, here's a very human song, one of my favorite Yiddish songs, by the great composer-poet Mordechai Gebirtig, Moishele Mein Freund, a loving song of reminiscence about lost youth and a lost world.
Oy, wo nimmt man zurück die Jahren, jene schöne Zeit. Eures junge, schöne Leben ist von euch schon weit. Oy, wo nimmt man zurück die Jahren, Mäuschle, mein Freund. Oy, noch jene bessere Rebbe, bängt das Herz noch ein. Was machst du, etwas, Mäuschle? Ich kenn dich noch im Blick. Du bist gewesen, mein Chaveru, mit Jahren viel zu reden. Und eure Kinder haben mich gelernt. Lange Nacht, heute steht der Rebbe noch vor mir. Der kann schicken in der Hand. Oi, wo nimmt man zurück die Jahre? Eures junge, schöne Leben ist früh schon weit. Oi, wo nimmt man zurück die Jahre, Mäuschen, mein Freund? Oi, noch jene böse Rebbe, bängt das Herz noch ein. Geht es etwas Berle, Rimmelis nach. Sammele und Jossele, sehr ruf und sehr getracht, geholen von euch Kindern, gesehen sie Kinder mit, geworden alte Jiddle, wie schnell das Leben flieht.
That was Leo Fold singing Moishele Mein Freund by the songwriter Mordechai Gebirtig. He was murdered by the Nazis in the Krakow ghetto. May his memory bring only blessings. When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest this morning will be Nathaniel Popkin, whose new novel explores how differences about Israel are roiling American synagogues right now. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people, an individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort? As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, award.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is KohanAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Nathaniel Popkin is the author of the new book, novel, Partly Strong, Partly Broken, very much about the American synagogue today, I would say. He is the author of 4 novels and 8 books, co-editor of the anthology Who Will Speak for America, and has written for a number of publications, not all Jewish, like the New York Times and so on. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hello, good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So this is something that comes very close to my heart right now, the question of how the American Jewish community, particularly the non-Orthodox American Jewish community, is responding to the situation in Israel. And you said it in 2023. Tell us what prompted you to write the book.
Yeah, thanks, Rabbi. Partly Strong, Partly Broken really is about the fragility of community. It's strength, of course. Both of those things are in the title. And I had just been observing for a long time and absorbing, I would say, the sense of conflict and division and the potential for things to really boil over within Jewish communities and, of course, within American life writ large, well before October 7th. And so the novel is set in the month before October 7th, and it ends just as the first news comes through that something is happening. And it's really meant to there's several reasons why I did it that way, but the first and foremost was to say that some of these tensions were already existent and already creating a lot of conflict for people and pain.
As a Reform rabbi, I can tell you I have a lot of colleagues, classmates of mine, who on a trip to Israel, I got a chance to spend a good deal of quality time with them, and they were talking about how they are, even though they're very liberal in many ways, strong supporters of Israel, but their kids are not. And they feel like they taught them how to care about everybody except other Jews. I don't know that any of them would want to be quoted on this, but this is a real challenge facing liberal Jews today. Have you experienced any of this personally?
Well, I certainly have. I've experienced it, you know, in multiple and numerous ways, and it really caused me to want to write this novel and to say I noticed something. I noticed that people were struggling over this issue because, and there is a generational difference for sure that you point out, people are not aligning with the behavior and the acts of the Israeli government, even those who love Israel. And the main character of Partly Strong, Partly Broken is a Reform rabbi who does love Israel in a certain way and has a long experience with it, as do many rabbis, but also is liberal and is inclined, I think, to be a little afraid to talk about it with her congregation because if she suggests that she supports one side or the other, there could be some kind of blowback. And that is something I have heard from rabbis. There was even a study done saying that, you know, this is before the current moment, but rabbis were avoiding it if they could.
Yeah.
That silence, tends to end up creating more tension.
We will talk much more with Nathaniel Popkin about his, I think, extremely cogent new book, Partly Strong, Partly Broken, a novel about rabbis and synagogues today and Israel, when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established over 7 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests. Always call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious School is signing people up now for school-age children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Torah Tikes experience for the youngest kids, Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Our services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come in person Friday night. Our Shabbat evening celebration services with full music are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, Torah study is at 9 a.m. Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., always followed by a delicious kiddush, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading services and study. Facebook page where you can go to services as well is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. Go to our website, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to find out about them and sign up. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, Torah Tikes program, religious school, First Friday Tot Kabbalat Shabbat for the youngest families, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing and warmest Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. Stream us from there. Download us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's a very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, Current Moment Magazine. Over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we started talking about colonialism last week, which has had such a profound impact on the development and evolution of the modern world. You talked about some of the positive, particularly infrastructure kinds of things, roads, railways, water supplies, sewage, all of those kinds of elements. That's, of course, not the whole story. Let's talk a little bit about some of the more negative impacts of colonialism when the British, the French, the Dutch, the Belgians, when the European powers expanded outward, Italians even, Germany a little bit, and established colonies all over the world.
Yeah, shockingly, most Americans have a pretty favorable opinion of the Dutch. They're tolerant. Everything is legal in the Netherlands. They have a gay prime minister, all that stuff. But among the colonial powers, they were just about the worst. Them and the Belgians.
Them and the Belgians, yep.
They're adjacent small countries in northwestern Europe. And the antagonism towards former colonizers is nowhere stronger than it is in former Dutch colonies, which include Indonesia,
yeah,
specifically, and former Belgian colonies, which includes the Congo.
Right.
And Rwanda and Burundi. So, you know, not everybody has fond memories of the colonial powers. In fact, it's usually the opposite. But, so, you and your family just came back from a trip to some former French colonies in Southeast Asia.
Right.
One of the worst defeats the U.S. ever faced in a foreign war was the Vietnam War, which we clearly lost. And who knew that it was going to be the first in a series of lost wars? And who knows when the last one will be?
But right.
I digress.
Yes.
One of my longest and most interesting postings in the Foreign Service, and that covers a lot of time and a lot of territory, but was in the former French colony, which in English is called the Ivory Coast, and in French it's called the Côte d'Ivoire. And that is in West Africa. And just to show you the ambivalence that people have towards the French, much of West Africa, with a few spotty exceptions like Ghana and Liberia, and a few others, Sierra Leone, but much of West Africa was French. And the French set up a financial community, an African financial community that used something called the CFA franc, which was tied at a fixed rate to the French franc in an effort to stabilize the economies of these countries. First, while they were colonies, it made sense that they all used the French franc. But then when they became independent, they all chose to remain part of this community. And it's interesting that they threw out French soldiers. They were very hostile to, in many cases, French school teachers. The little small business people who kept bakeries and cafes on every corner in West Africa were often pressured to leave. But the French franc stayed on, and it's still there. Even in the most ferociously anti-French countries, they choose to stay in that system because it benefits them. What benefited me as a... So I moved directly from Paris to Abidjan, the capital, then capital of the Côte d'Ivoire. Now it's Yamoussoukro, where Félix Houphouët-Boigny built himself the biggest basilica in the world, bigger than St. Peter's in Rome. And the city in which he built his cathedral is now technically the capital. Although, try flying there from anywhere.
Yeah.
Good luck. Anyway, when I lived in the Côte d'Ivoire, I was very pleasantly surprised to see that I could walk down to the corner of my street and find a French pâtisserie where everything tasted like it had been made in Paris. The croissant, the baguette, it was like there was nothing African about it. And it was kind of a total elimination, in a way, of local culture. And on lots of levels, like I would go out into the countryside to visit rural villages or to meet representatives of new tribes that I had never encountered before. And the local chieftain would welcome me with a bottle of room temperature champagne, which is really undrinkable.
That's true.
Because they had no way to keep it cool. But there are traditional welcome drinks in Africa that got totally erased by the impact of French, not only imperialism and colonialism, but supremacy.
Right.
You know, the French culture, language, food, drink were, in the minds of the colonial overlords, the best. And there was no disputing that. And, you know, in many countries, people from the colonial powers stayed on and chose to live their lives there because they felt they were living better than they did back home.
Right.
Even after wars of independence and, in many cases, lots of bloodshed in the streets and lots of bad feeling, not only the French, but a lot of Brits also stayed on.
Sure.
There are a lot of places, both in Africa and Asia, which still have British expatriate communities, not that have moved there recently, but are...
They've been there for generations, yeah.
Yeah.
Tom, we will talk more next week and complete, perhaps, our limited exploration of a very complex subject. Thanks so much.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Now, you might not be aware of this, but most Hasidim don't have TVs in their homes. That's the ultra-Orthodox Jews with the side locks, the payas. Anyway, one Hasidic guy, in spite of this, really wants to buy a TV. So he goes to a store in Brooklyn and he says to the salesman, "I want to buy that TV." But the salesman says, "We don't sell TVs to Hasidim."
Undeterred, the guy goes home, changes into jeans and a t-shirt, puts on a baseball cap, tucks his payas, those sideburn fringes, into his cap, and goes back to the store. He says to the salesman, "I want to buy that TV." But the salesman says, "We don't sell TVs to Hasidim." Now the guy is really frustrated and mad, but he's also determined. He goes home. He shaves off his beard and his payas, buys a total hipster outfit, puts it on, even gets a tattoo. Finally, he goes back to the store and he says to the salesman, "I want to buy that TV." But the salesman says, "We don't sell TVs to Hasidim." The guy is furious. "How did you know I'm a Hasid?" And the salesman says, "Because that's a microwave oven." I love that joke. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Not that old. A special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the dramatic portion of Shlach Lecha in the book of Numbers, the story of the Meraglim, the spies. The Israelites have journeyed to the very borders of the Holy Land just a year and a half after leaving Egyptian slavery. Under God's direction, Moses sends 12 spies, one from each tribe, princes of the people, wealthy men of standing, into the land of Canaan to scout out the land and see if it can be captured. The spies take a month to tour the whole land. They report back to Moses, Canaan is very good. It flows with milk and honey. They bring back a huge cluster of grapes, so large it must be carried by two men on a pole. That's now the enduring symbol of Israel's tourism ministry. Everything's going to be great. Only it's not. 10 of the 12 spies proceed to report that the people of the land are huge. "We felt like grasshoppers next to them," they say. "And there are many of them, and the cities are fortified and unassailable. The Israelites have no chance to capture Canaan in spite of having God's support. It's all hopeless." Two spies, Caleb and Joshua, deliver a minority report. They say that with God's help, the land can be taken, but the people are terrified. Again, they ask Moses and Aaron, "Why did you take us out of slavery only to kill us here at the hands of our enemies?" So at this point, God decides. This generation of former slaves will never be able to become a free people in its own land. The psychological shackles of slavery are too strong to overthrow in just one generation. These people must remain in the Sinai wilderness until the adults all die off, and a new generation arises that has not known slavery and its defeatist mentality. Stung by the verdict, the people turn again and attempt a leaderless invasion of the land without God's support. It fails dismally, and the people of Israel are now condemned to wander the wilderness for 38 more years, a total of 40 since they left Egypt, until a new young generation can emerge to take the reins and enter the land with a fresh perspective, having been born into freedom. It's a great lesson in the process that is required to cleanse the trauma of failure from the minds of a community. Often it's not one single act of great revolution that truly remakes a people, a country, or an organization. It's the generational turn that comes from learning things can be done differently and better, that freedom is a birthright to be defended. In our own lives, we Jews today often share our ancestors' tendency to believe failure is permanent, success temporary. Shlach Lecha shows the danger of such belief. The importance of having faith in God and in our own ability to change for the better. Ultimately, the Israelites do enter the land of their eternal inheritance for good. We too, modern Israelites, if you will, have the capacity to create new, valuable, even wonderful things, both individually and most importantly collectively. We too can enter new lands, create new organizations, synagogues, communities. What's required is faith in the support of God and the flexibility to learn, grow, and embrace change for the better. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Nathaniel Popkin, explains why he chose to write about the challenges Israel poses for a contemporary Reform rabbi and congregation, and why he stopped the text of the book before October 7, 2023. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world.
with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
President Donald Trump is claiming credit for another truce between Hezbollah and Israel about 2 months after surprising both sides by declaring a ceasefire that has, well, barely existed ever since. However, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu said nothing much has changed in Israel's approach to battling Hezbollah in Lebanon. I had a conversation with Bibi Netanyahu today asking him not to go into a major raid of Beirut, Lebanon. He turned his troops around. Thank you, Bibi, Trump posted. I also had a conversation with representatives of the leaders of Hezbollah, and they agreed to stop shooting at Israel and its soldiers. Likewise, Israel agreed to stop shooting at them. Let's see how long that lasts. Hopefully it will be for eternity. That post followed another similar message published earlier in which Trump said, there will be no troops going to Beirut, and any troops that are on their way have already been turned back. Netanyahu confirmed he spoke with Trump, but not that he agreed to a ceasefire. I spoke with President Trump and told him if Hezbollah does not cease attacking our cities and citizens, Israel will attack terror targets in Beirut. The stance of ours remains unchanged, Netanyahu said. In parallel, the IDF will continue to operate as planned in southern Lebanon. Lebanese embassy in Washington said Lebanon learned that Hezbollah agreed to a U.S. proposal for a ceasefire. Unfortunately, that was later contradicted by Hezbollah. All of this came after heavy fighting in Lebanon. Multiple Israeli soldiers have been killed by Hezbollah drones. Israel spurred an evacuation in the outskirts of Beirut after warning it will launch an operation against Hezbollah outposts located there. The hostilities in Lebanon and northern Israel reflect a distinct front in the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. When Trump declared a ceasefire in the Iran war in early April, Israel maintained it did not apply to Hezbollah, an Iranian proxy. Trump, however, insisted Netanyahu cease fighting in Lebanon, too. 2 months later now, Trump is still negotiating for a permanent end to the Iran war. Last week, the president said on CNBC that he found the talks to be very boring and did not care if the Iranians dropped out of the discussions. I see. Or don't? Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney announced a new government body to combat racism last week, saying its first priority is tackling anti-Semitism. Carney addressed Canada's surge in anti-Semitic hate crimes during a speech at Holy Blossom Synagogue, Toronto's oldest and best-named Jewish congregation. He said the government of Canada had to start with clearly admitting Canada's civic compact is failing Jewish Canadians. Over two-thirds of Canada's religion-motivated hate crimes last year were directed at Jewish Canadians, who make up 1% of the population. Do the math. Carney's government launched the Ministerial Advisory Council on Rights, Equality, and Inclusion, advising Canada's government on combating all forms of hate. I am directing the first responsibility of that council is to address anti-Semitism, he said. The council is chaired by the Minister of Canadian Identity and Culture, Mark Miller. It is tasked with reassessing the nature, scale, and drivers of anti-Semitism, developing an entire government approach to align federal policies and public safety programs, improving the collection of data on hate incidents, and measuring the impact of government efforts. Jewish organizations will be disappointed that Carney's announcement did not include sweeping enforcement measures against anti-Semitism. Rich Robertson, Director of Research and Advocacy at B'nai B'rith Canada, said the speech was a missed opportunity. B'nai B'rith is advocating a task force that responds immediately to anti-Semitic incidents and a commission of inquiry to identify the root causes. We were hoping for true tactical changes that could positively be actioned to change the lived experience of Jewish Canadians. Unfortunately, that is not what we received today, Robertson said. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Nathaniel Popkin is the author of 4 novels and 8 books, the co-editor of the anthology Who Will Speak for America. He's written about Jewish ideals and the reality of our world, and he's written for many other publications. His new book, Partly Strong, Partly Broken, is very much about what synagogues are like today. We were talking earlier in the show about how difficult Israel has become for some liberal rabbis. Just recently at a conference, a friend of mine, Rabbi Ami Hirsch, said we shouldn't ordain rabbis who are not Zionists. I think Adina, the lead, your protagonist in the book, the rabbi, is a Zionist. I mean, she believes in a Jewish state, even if she doesn't like the current government and a lot of the policies. But that's not, there is a definite kind of divide. Explain how you explored that in the book.
Yeah, for sure. So Rabbi Adina is, it's interesting. I don't use the word Zionist very much in the novel because
Right. It
wasn't being used every 5 minutes as it is now.
That's true.
To label.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, it wasn't being used every 5 minutes as it is now 3 years ago. Like, this isn't ancient history, right? Before October 7th, you didn't hear Zionist all the time.
That's exactly it. So I don't think the word was ever used in the novel. Rabbi Adina has a long relationship to Israel. She, as the novel opens, she is just returning from spending some time there. She had a long time and very important love relationship with a Palestinian Israeli woman. And she had just been visiting her and staying with her. And she had participated in the anti-government protests that really were taking over Israeli life in 2023. And she participated in that out of a love for what she thought Israel could and should be. So would we say the rabbi in the novel is very comfortable with Israel being a significant object and subject of Jewish life in America? She is on her way to trying to create in the synagogue something she calls the Hebrew Learning Center because she wants more of her congregants to learn the language and be comfortable with it beyond the liturgy. She thinks that will create more community and bring people together. And she is someone who is a giving and empathetic person, and she's also willful. And of course, in fiction, one's will can sometimes come back to haunt you. But she is, in the course of the novel, which is the month before October 7th, seeing conflict break out among her congregants and in the multi-faith world that she participates in her community writ large. And she is really struggling to navigate some difficult things. And I think that's pretty consistent in American life. We may forget that, you know, there are many versions of being Jewish and many ideologies that intersect with being Jewish, and they're not all Zionist. And, you know, that is starting to bubble up here.
The challenge of the politics of a synagogue would sound familiar to any of us who have been congregational rabbis or are congregational rabbis. I'm not sure that Jewish lay people, that is, non-rabbis, are so familiar with all of that. You wrote it well. How did you come to do that research?
Well, first of all, thank you, Rabbi, because, you know, I am not a rabbi. And I'm not even someone who regularly attends a synagogue. On the other hand, as a writer, a lot of us are pretty sensitive people. We observe, we absorb. I did grow up, I was bar mitzvahed, I did participate in the life of a synagogue growing up, a Reform synagogue.
And where was that, if I can ask?
That was in Trenton, New Jersey, and Har Sinai. Very classic German Jewish oriented synagogue whose origins also go back to the days of raising money for Palestine, to colonize Palestine, words used verbatim. And I guess, and then my kids were bar and bat mitzvahed in a synagogue here in Philadelphia. And in that process, I would go and observe. And then it's just the world around me, secular, not secular, Jewish, not Jewish. And then, I did as much research as I possibly could so that you might be able to say I did a good job because, of course, I live in constant fear that something isn't right. Of course, I had a a rabbi, a sensitivity reader, and others familiar reading it as well. I really tried my best. But I thought I was tapping into a moment of kind of cultural change here that I was observing and that I think is real, and where the sort of last couple several generations assumption that American Jewry is absolutely aligned with the desires and approaches of Israel may be coming to an end. And those kids of the rabbi you spoke about earlier are kind of evidence of that, as we can see it, you know, truly playing out most ferociously within the younger people. And there are younger people in this novel who themselves have varying beliefs.
The challenge of how to respond and really how to feel about Israel kind of is all through this book. I mean, Adina goes and spends a summer in Haifa. She comes back to the synagogue, and then kind of all hell breaks loose. I don't know. It may not be the most Jewish way to express it, but all kinds of stuff, from the physical damage to the synagogue by natural disasters, you know, leaks, whatever, stuff like that, to all the politics bubbling up within the synagogue about her attitude towards the synagogue, her attitude towards Israel. Tell us how October 7th impacted this, because all of this really takes place, you know, before everything happens.
Yeah, so I had actually written this novel, or a form of it, a version of it, an earlier version of it, in spring, finishing up in summer of 2023. Went through a revision process, felt it was ready to go, started sending it out in fall of 2023 and in September.
Boy.
And
what timing?
What timing, right? So then October 7th happens, the response to October 7th starts unfolding, and I realized the novel I had written is no longer appropriate. So I had to scrap it. And then still believing it had something to say, whether that's correct or not, I don't know, but believing that, I set out to rewrite it, and I wasn't sure how I should. It certainly, the tone had to become even more serious. The character, Rabbi Adina, grew into a more tragic and also more dynamic figure. But I had to decide whether to carry the action of the novel beyond October 7th, and I really struggled with this question and decided ultimately not to.
Right.
I wanted to give the reader, you know, the reader knows what's coming, and the characters don't, and I thought that would be really, from a literary perspective, really good tension on the page. And I also struggled to imagine writing characters post-October 7th, especially in the months right after it. People responded from their tightly held beliefs and alliances, and there was a stridency in the response on all sides that would have been translated into cartoonish characters on the page, and I could not do that.
I think it's almost too soon to write novels about the last couple of years. It's just been so much. I don't know if that's true, but that's sort of how it feels to me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's legitimacy to that?
I do, and that's really why I cut it off at around midnight on October 7th, because it's still playing out. It's a story that's not over. We don't even understand the extent of horrors on all sides. And at the same time, we're watching this subject, this issue, this pain, this multi-generational trauma take form in our present-day lives in so many ways, within synagogue communities, outside of them, in schools, in universities, in organizations, in political campaigns, obviously, even within Jewish organizations like the Jewish Book Council. It's still playing out. I don't know how anyone could sort of could really put it on the page. You know, when it's on the page, it's like it's firm.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't move.
Well, that's true. It leads itself to the, you know, many interpretations, but it doesn't change. I was thinking, you know, about how much of the divisions we're seeing in the Jewish community were already there, you know, the iceberg beneath the surface, and then the fractures that we're seeing, not only between Jews and former allies, but also within the Jewish world. And as we said, the generational conflict, that all of that was actualized by the events of October 7th and the Gaza War and now the Iran War and all this subsequent stuff. But they were there before. And I think you do a really wonderful job of bringing that out.
Thank you.
Does this community survive?
I might have to ask you.
Well, I was asking about your synagogue community in the book, but I...
Yeah, no.
You're right. It's a much larger question. I want to thank Nathaniel Popkin for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about Partly Strong, Partly Broken?
Well, I have a website called nathanielpopkin.net, and I can be found there. I can easily be found anywhere on the internet, on social media. Typically, I have a Substack, which I'm glad to have more people following, called 2 Feet on the Ground. The book is published by New Door Books. They can be found on the internet as well. And the book is sold everywhere. Books are sold.
Nathaniel, thank you so much. Best of luck.
Thank you, Rabbi Sam. Take care.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Paul Levine, author of the new Charlie Chaplin Albert Einstein thriller novel, Midnight Patriots. And join us at Beit Simcha every Friday night. Services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2. 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org for our service and class schedule, to sign up for our new Torah Tykes membership, and to attend our Tat Kabbalat Shabbat. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from the recent Eurovision competition. Israel's Noam Batan finished second. It's Israel's entry, his song Michelle, in French, Hebrew, English, and maybe other languages. My friends, may you have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona. איך השארת אותי בצל, כוכבת בלי תהילה, משוגעת גדולה, אני קם ונופל. או מישל, je ne sais plus quoi faire, tu étais ma lumière, Dieu, je t'en supplie, réveille-moi. J'ai plongé dans le noir, amène-moi de l'espoir, et ma mademoiselle. Alors je danse, danse avec les mots. Tu me verras rire, rire à nouveau. T'es ma douleur, j'étais qu'un décor. J'ai crié, crié, crié. Michel, je te laisse partir. Adieu ma belle, je te laisse. Je te laisse.